Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. COVID-19 has applied some fresh pressure to an already overloaded child welfare system in the U.S. and the already traumatized children at the heart of that system. More than 400,000 youth are in foster care across the country, with 300 in Franklin County alone in need of a foster home. The pandemic has closed family courts, sidelined caseworkers, and slowed the process for family reunification. Most parental visits are taking place online, and concerns about infection have chilled foster parent recruitments. Coming up, we're going to hear more about the local challenges on the program. Right now, Laura Sathanam is reporting on the issue for PBS NewsHour. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me in. I really appreciate it.
What do we know about times of great national stress, the Great Recession, and how they affect the welfare system and children's welfare in general?
So, when there are times of great crisis, we find that people who are in, vulnerable positions, tend to really bear the brunt of that. And that is absolutely true when it comes to children and, abuse and instances of abuse and neglect. Research shows us that during times of, great, stress, like the financial recession, we saw incidents of child abuse and neglect go up, which kind of runs counter to some of the more frequent official counts that we see, the year-to-year data that during that same period, it looked as though child abuse and neglect were going down. Part of that, researchers who are paying attention to this suggested that, it's because the people who catch those instances, like, teachers and pediatricians, aren't always in as close of contact because of all the disruptions that are going on in people's lives at the time.
The numbers did go down after an initial uptick in 2007. I mean, we can't really make a lot of calls regarding the pandemic at this point, but looking back at the Great Recession of 2007, what do we know about that and why that happened?
Right. So you're absolutely right. As far as like what's going on right now, it's too soon to tell. The data is just not available yet. But looking back at the recession, it was a time, again, of great stress. You saw people losing their jobs, losing their homes. And when federal researchers were looking back at the incidence of child maltreatment, they realized that those numbers may actually be going up. And so, in a report that the Child Advocacy Group First Focus released in 2015, it was suggested that there needs to be more analysis, more resources put into understanding why one set of numbers suggests that child abuse and neglect are going down when other sources are saying that it's going up. It's something that people are trying to figure out, and especially right now.
There's different categories of kids in this system, and one that's often overlooked are older teens. A lot of them are just waiting it out in homeless shelters at this point. They're aging out of the system, but they still could be getting some kind of help, but there's no place for them to go.
Right. For older kids who are in foster care, this has been a particularly disruptive time. The Federal Children's Bureau, which is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, they recently wrote child welfare leaders a letter just sort of calling to the attention of, these kids who had been in foster care who maybe in college, for example, right? When campuses closed down and students were told to go home, many of these kids had lost the only home they had. Uh-huh. So this is, there are these sort of gaps in the system that, again, people who are in vulnerable positions are really sort of bearing the brunt of what this pandemic is bringing to the fore.
And then as far as the chilling effect it's have on recruiting, there's always a shortage of foster parents. This cannot be a good sign for that in that camp.
Right. In conversations I was having as recently as yesterday with with child advocacy groups. One concern that they brought up was there's been a growing number of grand families, so to speak, grandparents who are raising their grandchildren and younger family members because of, various disruptions in the family. Because older people are at a heightened risk of, enduring severe health outcomes if they are infected with COVID-19, that's really become a cause for alarm with these families. How do I isolate if, I'm trying to take care of my grandchild? This pandemic has really raised a lot of questions that demand answers, and people are struggling to come up with even just sort of temporary solutions to address those.
So much of the child welfare system in the United States revolves around the courts, the family courts. How are they managing this?
It's been really difficult. One thing that's come up is even just looking at monitoring cases. So social workers, they still need to conduct monthly case management meetings and check in on families who might be at risk, right? Those visits are supposed to be conducted in person, but caseworkers are concerned they could catch or spread the virus while going from house to house. Again, the Federal Children's Bureau has permitted states to allow caseworkers to conduct these visits using video conferencing tools or smartphone apps, but that's not a perfect solution either. Not everyone may have a phone that's capable of doing those sessions, or even have a phone, period. Another issue that's come up is, some of these video conferencing sessions may miss telltale signs of abuse or neglect, or even just, things not going as everyone would hope. And so, and a caseworker might, be able to better pick up on those signals during an in-person visit. So again, not a lot of perfect solutions right now.
Right, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if there is a report, do we know, are children still being removed at this point?
It's a good question. I mean, a lot of that has really slowed down.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that we're keeping an eye on.
And is there a sense that the states are looking at the systems right now and are concerned about them themselves? We know that, for instance, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is concerned about this issue. He believes that the reports are down because the reporters don't have contact with the kids like they used to. Is that a commonly held belief, across the states?
That's absolutely right. As far as, and it's one of the key risk factors right now is that, children are more isolated, and as well as their caregivers. So, whereas before, people kind of, either were able to go to jobs or kids were able to go to school and sort of interact with others, and people, outside the home might have a sense of, things seem to be okay, or things seem to be, kind of getting, stretched thin. That safety net, as imperfect as it was, is just not there right now. And especially with kids staying home, not going into the classroom, teachers not noticing, signs of, harm or being able to note if something is not quite right. That protection is not there. And I understand that there in Ohio, that's also come up as recently as this week, that kids are going to remain home. There's a lot of cause for concern. Some states are looking at this. California has put forward, plans to sort of bolster efforts to protect kids, but it's something that a lot of states are already stretched thin after years of grappling with the repercussions of the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
And how that uprooted so many families and placed kids in maybe outside of the care of their biological parents. So it's going from one extreme and layering on a completely new set of hurdles, and states are really struggling right now to figure out how to do this, and that's definitely weighing on child welfare.
Your April 6th story for PBS NewsHour started with a physician and talking about this in Fort Worth, Texas, that had seen seven children and infants who had been abused so severely that they required hospitalization. And that was in the course of five consecutive days in March. And the point was that typically the hospital sees fewer than 10 cases of fatal child abuse in a year. But that week, two died from their injuries. Is this, what do they make of that now, about a month later?
Right. The physician who I spoke to, Dr. Jamie Kaufman in Fort Worth, Texas, she mentioned that even in her own practice, she knows it's too early, really, because the data is just not available to see if this is part of a broader trend. Was it a tragic, just sort of snapshot of that moment, or is this something bigger? When I spoke to her, she said that she had seen something similar happen during the financial crisis a few years back. And so, rather than wait for the data to pan out, which takes several months to come together, she, just in an attempt to prevent any more kids from getting harmed, she sort of rang that bell and, spoke to local news, spoke to us, spoke to other outlets to just bring this to people's attention, other pediatricians, other families, and members in the community, so that people, can sort of construct a patchwork of just paying attention so that kids who, again, might be at risk, don't have to endure the effects of abuse and neglect.
You interviewed the director of the Center for Community Engaged Medicine at Tufts, and they shared some advice about how to manage the kids at this time. Did they tell you about what kind of strategies did they share with you?
Sure. Dr. Robert Sege, he said, right now is if a lot of people, again, are feeling isolated because of, social distancing. It's great public health policy. It's all we've got in absence of a vaccine or, proven medicines to treat COVID-19. So we're all just trying to stay put so that we don't, infect others or become infected ourselves with this virus. In doing that, a lot of people, again, are feeling isolated, and that can really sort of turn up the heat on a stressful situation. To sort of give vent to that, to prevent things from becoming, really dangerous and tragic, Dr. Sege suggested, call a friend, call a pediatrician, send your child to a quiet corner, take a walk outside if that's safe to do, maintain safe social distance of at least 6 feet, from anyone who doesn't live in your household already. And then for infants, he suggested, place them in a crib, take a step away, draw a deep breath, cool off. And there's also several, helplines that are available. There's the Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline, 1-800-4-A-CHILD. After this story came out, I heard from them, and they said, they have seen in recent days their calls go up 31%. Their calls, text, and chats, I should say. They've gone up 31%, compared to just, recent times. So those resources are there, and people are there to help.
That number is 1-800-4-A-CHILD. We'll have that and more links and telephone numbers for places to call, contact if you're in distress, need help, don't know where to go, on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Laura Sathanam, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Sathanam is a reporter for PBS NewsHour. We'll have a link to her article from April 6th about how child welfare experts fear a spike of abuse during COVID-19. We are going to take a closer look at Franklin County now and the surrounding area and what services are out there and how the agencies responsible for child welfare are managing the issue during the COVID-19 pandemic. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In times of large-scale stress, the rate of child abuse tends to increase. During the pandemic, however, the trend line has been down. Governor Mike DeWine recently cautioned against taking the numbers at face value.
The reports of child abuse are down. I think we can fairly say that that's not because child abuse is down. It is because we do not have enough eyes on these children.
That is the teachers, counselors, coaches, neighbors, and social workers who typically report are now out of range due to social distancing. Ann Woodford is director of foster care at the Buckeye Ranch, a private nonprofit organization that provides emotional, behavioral, and mental health to more than 2,350 youths every day. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Chip Spinning is executive director of the Franklin County Children's Services. Welcome to the show, Chip.
Good morning.
What's happening in Central Ohio with this? What are you seeing at this point that tells us anything?
Well, I think to talk about the numbers briefly, in Franklin County specifically, in March we saw a reduction of about 20% in our referrals. And in April, we're at 48% for the first 15 days.
48% reduction.
48% reduction. But I think, you know, what the governor says is true. There are less eyes on kids. I think it's incredibly important as a community that, you know, child protection is a community responsibility. And this is a time when neighbors can step up and churches and anybody really can to really look out and help support our families that are struggling through this difficult time.
Is there any advice you give to people who ordinarily might be those ones to step up, but they're just not, they don't know what to look for at this point?
Well, we produced quite a bit of media releases to really inform the community to look out for any kind of concerns that you would have. It's much more difficult when families are, you know, staying at home and they're isolated. They may have different economic insecurities or food insecurities and those kinds of things. But just changes in behaviors and just those kinds of routine things that I think, unfortunately, our community sometimes are not as vigilant of paying attention to each other and their neighbors and that kind of stuff. And this is the time to check up on your neighbors as much as you can using social distancing. And
what do you see, Ann Woodford, from where you sit, Ann Woodford?
So it's interesting that our data for March, I know, is a little different in that we don't know. And I think an earlier guest of yours spoke to this, Ann, is that in March, we actually did see an increase, which is not consistent with the statewide numbers that we have. So we on an average month see about 22 children placed, and in March we saw 27. Through April of, actually through Monday of this week, we had referrals from 14 counties, and 83 children were referred to us during that period. Now, not all of those children entered our care because maybe we didn't have a home for them, or we couldn't meet one of their needs. But we are interested to see the data, as everyone is speaking to, in regards to our March numbers. We actually saw a mid-March peak, and then things seem to have flattened off for us in the early parts of April. So I think it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see how things unfold as we get increasing numbers statewide.
What's your sense about that, given the numbers that you have seen? Is there any pattern that's suggesting something over or something else? I mean, it's not the, is it, are they the typical referrals? Are they all the typical raises? Is everything otherwise normal?
So it appears that things are and referrals are coming in through the traditional pathway. So we haven't targeted a specific population. You know, one of the things that we do know is that if our agency could recruit families, and agencies, honestly, across Central Ohio could recruit homes for teenagers, that can, pre-COVID, that was a need that we had. And so we see that exacerbated in these times. You know, we hope to have kids transition out of congregate care settings, like residential settings, into a more family-like setting. And so that is definitely an area that we're trying to focus on. But we aren't seeing anything atypical at this point. We're really receiving kids from birth who are maybe showing up at birth with being addicted to something or drug exposed from birth mom, all the way through 18-year-olds who are in need of child placement.
I guess the at birth doesn't surprise me, because at least the hospitals have play a role in that, right?
Yes. Yeah, so a significant thing that we're predicting, and again, the numbers will tell us, is that exactly what Chip spoke to and your earlier guest spoke to, is that we aren't seeing kids, kids aren't being seen by their teachers, and teachers are, you know, good mandated reporters for us. So we do have concerns about, will there be a post-pandemic balloon for us? How do we prepare for that? So yeah. I think it's the separation of mandated reportings. And I know we've talked to our foster families a lot about, if you formerly had a child and you know that that family has a risk factor, don't be afraid to touch base with the birth family and say, are you doing okay? Do you need my support during this time? Because a large percentage of our kids go to reunification, so they are returned to their family, and we're asking our parents to be vigilant during this time as well.
Chip Spinning, are you concerned? I mean, what are the concerns about foster families at this point? What are they telling you they're struggling with?
Exactly what Ann says. So while our referrals are down, we are still having kids that cannot be safely maintained in their own families. We're still doing assessments. Our caseworkers are incredible in that they're still going out and managing face-to-face visits.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. And so we still have kids every day that we're looking to find placements for. And Ann is correct in that there are challenges with the capacity prior to this. And so this is a great opportunity to think about in the future, how can we increase the interest in families stepping forward and being interested in being foster parents, particularly for our teens. During this time period, it's been very challenging because there wasn't the capacity. And now with these additional kids and the challenges to place them, it's been challenging. But foster parents have been great, and family members have been great. We've fortunately been able to still place all of our youth who need safe placements to this point.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the plight of the foster care system and child welfare systems in Ohio, and particularly in Central Ohio. You just heard Chip Spinning. He is executive director of the Franklin County Children's Services. And also with us, Ann Woodford. She's director of foster care for the Buckeye Ranch. If you have a question or comment, if you have your own story to tell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a foster parent who's going to be joining us later in the program, but we'd love to hear from foster parents about what you're seeing, what your challenges are, what you're worried about, what's working, what isn't. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I read that nationally, there have been issues with parents who are refusing, foster parents who are refusing to accept new children. Have you had an issue with that, Chip Spinning? You're saying no, that your foster system's entrenched and taking in kids still?
Well, I think that, I think to be fair, it's probably evolved a little bit over the course of this event, and that initially folks were a little bit more resistant. But we have placed many kids with foster homes, and we've placed a lot of kids with their birth or their grandparents, kinship families, those kinds of things. So we've been able to make ends meet and serve kids' needs. But it has been challenging, particularly for our adolescents.
The older kids, yeah.
older kids, we're seeing a lot of disruptions. You know, kids don't always follow rules.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about social distancing and all the guidelines, they can cause a lot of stress within a family when they're not being as appropriate with some of these new sort of guidelines that we have in place. And that causes a lot of stress. And so we're seeing a lot of disruptions from birth families, even from foster care placements and kinship placements. But other foster parents are still stepping up, and we're, you know, able to figure out ways to keep kids stable.
What about that issue that was raised in the last segment by the PBS reporter about youth, emancipated youth, who still have open case files and who would be relying on college dorm housing right now? What about them?
So I think that is a challenge. I know that we have a group of staff members that reach out to youth, but to be honest, some of them are connected with us and some of them aren't. And the ones that are, we can see if we can find host homes and support them in some kind of way, whether it's lots and lots of youth will find, if they were with a foster parent before, sometimes they can go back to those settings during this time. But we need to learn from this and take a look at it and see in the future, is there a better plan?
Well, and particularly, I would say that one of the things I think, too, is that a lot of places, I know at the Buckeye Ranch, for example, we have a My Place Center that helps kids transitioning out. And typically, we aren't always at capacity, and we now are encouraging and trying to expand capacity slightly, which is one of the things that the state has allowed us to do to be able to serve those kids that are in those at-risk categories for homelessness or couch surfing.
It's a residential?
So it is a transitional age housing and independent living setting.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, sometimes kids are in college and have the dorm for a safety net. So one of the things that we've explored at the Buckeye Ranch is how can we add that additional capacity in our space so that we know there are those kids that are in transition out of Ohio State that need a place to go. And we've been able to add a little capacity there to serve additional kids who might otherwise go to homelessness.
Do either of you have any connections with Star House, which helps homeless teens? A lot of them are former foster care clients. Chip Spinning, anything that they need, or do you know of what they're working on?
I think they're a great resource for particularly these young adults, and also Huck House also supports that space as well. And they have a relationship back and forth with our staff. We'll continue to support youth until I think it's age 25. So if they need different supports, whether it's help with rent or those kinds of things, they definitely touch base back and forth with youth. And then the Bridges program, which Ann could probably talk a little bit more about, just came around a couple years ago to help support youth until they're 21.
What about that, Ann?
Yes, so we do have the Bridges program, and it's, again, a program that we're involved with that supports those kids who otherwise might not have a family member to have reunified with and can get support through 21 based on certain criteria that we've established here in Ohio that allow those kids to have a worker who ensures that those kids continue to have their, you know, housing needs met as well as food relief and food supports. So that program is run throughout Ohio in different capacities, which does allow us, that was just part of new legislative change, the Bridges program several years ago, that allows us in Ohio to step up and do a little better job of ensuring our kids in that transitional population have support and case managers who can ensure that they're, you know, have utility support and things like that.
According to the government, the kids are entitled to some money from the $2.2 billion relief legislation. Chip Spinning, who gets that money and who's entitled to it?
I don't have the details on that to speak specifically.
Has anyone questioned?
No, I haven't heard anything specifically about that, so I'll have to do some research and figure that out. We can share that with you.
Okay. Ann Woodford, do you have any insights on that?
You know, I don't honestly have the details of that, and I know that it will impact some of our kids, I believe, and that, again, back in that transitional population, but I don't have details.
Okay. We have an email from Patrick. Of the children who are in foster care, 47% of their parents have trouble paying for basic necessities, yet under the Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1997, states are encouraged to invest in adoption instead of reunifying families. We should talk about supports to keep children safely in their home during this pandemic. What is the rule on that score, Chip Spinning?
Well, I think he's speaking specifically to adoption versus reunification.
Mm-hmm.
It's currently we're supporting families in their own homes if they need assistance with food cards or help with rent or those kinds of things, sort of helping meet those economic needs that they may have. And Job and Family Services is also supporting families with some TANF dollars to help support them through this challenging time. I think the legislation that he's speaking to specifically also looked at the time frames in which a child is in and out of home placement, actually in the custody of, for example, Franklin County Children's Services, and creates urgency to assure that children are achieved permanency in 11 out of 22 months. And so I think that a contributing factor that we're going to experience right now is that with the courts being slowed down to non-essential court hearings, there is some concern that cases won't move as quickly as what we need to have happen so that kids can achieve permanency either through reunification or adoption or potential legal custody to a relative. One of the things that we've been able to do is take some of our staff that, for example, would do facilitate family team meetings. And since we're not having those meetings right now, they're doing case mining to find cases that could likely move to a reunification soon so that we can expedite those so that hopefully they're not lingering.
Well, when it comes to non-essential court proceedings, what does that mean when it comes to child welfare?
So, for example, if we would get an investigation of a child and we can't find a safe place for the child and we need to take custody of the child, then we're going to have a hearing. We can never take custody of a child without the court being involved. So we would still have those hearings.
And that's the only hearings that are considered essential right now?
There's other essential hearings. It would be more on a case-by-case basis that would be considered, but for routine update hearings, those are not occurring.
And how are those proceedings, how do they occur? Is it remotely, that kind of a thing, or are they in person?
I believe that most of them are remotely right now.
Hmm. Well, Ann Woodford, what are your greatest needs at this point? You said that you're kind of bracing yourself for a balloon when the when the pandemic ends, but we don't even know when that's going to be at this point.
Yeah. So what I would say is that our needs in terms of, we need compassionate, flexible families who are willing to step up for kids in our communities, whether it's with our agency or other agencies. The demand is high. We need to protect our children. We need to provide them supportive environments that they can thrive in. And that's really what my plea to the community would be at this point is, what can you consider being a compassionate person to open your home and support a child or an adolescent during this time? We've had great community response in terms of our kids, and a lot of our kids don't have the ability to have technology, and people have stepped up and done material support. We have wish lists for our COVID shelter that is going up of items that we need there. So if you'd like to visit our Facebook page or if you would like to visit our website, there are lots of ways you can donate, even population specific. But for the foster care perspective, I would say the number one thing that we need is safe, compassionate homes who can be flexible and support our children.
I have a former foster parent emailed me, Kate, and wants to know if there are any plans to do any super quick training, recertifications to bring back former foster parents She said it usually takes 13-some weeks of training and lots of home visits, et cetera, before being licensed, all for good reason. But is there a fast-track option for someone like us to provide emergency relief? Ann Woodford?
Yes, I will definitely say that the process has changed quickly since the start of pandemic. I have been impressed that previously all of the training was in person. It was not done online, and we have very quickly moved to a tele option where foster parents can go online and get proctored training with our training coordinator, or we even have some foster parent college is a college that does all of the pre-service training, which is the training that families need prior to becoming licensed. And we definitely are trying to do a lot of visits via telehealth, make them longer and shorten the number of home studies that you need, all while being diligent about, you know, making sure that we're putting kids in safe places. So I would say the process is definitely in the pandemic environment shortened and much more tech savvy at this point.
And Chip Spinning, same with you guys or what?
Well, we don't have our own foster home, so okay. We rely on the Buckeye Ranch and other partners. But the rules have definitely improved through this process to expedite it.
All right. Well, Ann Woodford, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Ann Woodford is director of foster care at the Buckeye Ranch. It provides emotional, behavioral, and mental health to more than 2,350 youths a day. We're going to be hearing from a foster parent that works with the Buckeye Ranch, so stay with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the child welfare system in the era of COVID-19. Among other things, concerns about infections have chilled foster parent recruitments across the country. Still with us is Chip Spinning. He's executive director of Franklin County Children's Services. And joining us is Kate Yonkera. She and her husband have been foster parents with Buckeye Ranch for 4 years. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Thank you for having me.
You and your husband, Ray, have 4 children of your own, and you've cared for 12 foster children over the last 4 years. You typically parent infants or young children with significant medical issues. Have you reconsidered your commitment during the pandemic?
Most definitely not. We might be in a unique situation, but we received placement of 2 foster youth during the month of March. So right in the crux of this change over. And so, you know, I guess I would say the need for foster parents and for safe placements for children is greater now. And, you know, I would definitely encourage people who had ever considered being foster parents to, you know, make the phone call.
Do you have connections with other foster parents?
Yes, I do.
Because I'm kind of wondering, isn't it natural that, I mean, not everybody keeps their job during this time? Is there additional stress on foster parents who weren't planning on having the kids home from school, for instance? I know yours are typically younger, but what are you hearing from your other colleagues out there in the world?
Well, my foster parent support kind of have a unified voice at this time of we just simply are trying our best to adjust to the rapidly changing requirements of home education. I think that might be, you know, aside from some insecurities with jobs and food, I think some of our top stressors are just, you know, first and foremost, following the stay-home orders with our children to keep everyone safe, and then also just adjusting to the virtual world of home education.
Huh. And visitations and that kind of a thing, right?
Yes, really everything has changed. So normally I have social workers coming into my home to check the welfare of the children. And now it's a virtual meeting. So what that looks like today is I'm holding a telephone in one hand with a video, you know, videoing my home. I'm giving social workers access to the children live in my home. And even sometimes those home visits happen on my front porch in a socially distanced manner. But also home, you know, visitations with biological families for the children we care for have changed dramatically in that they're not in person anymore. Before, the kids visited one or two times a week with their parents in maybe in Franklin County's, you know, office.
Mm-hmm.
And now those visits are also virtual. So I have, you know, my children's biological parents in a live video in my home, which is definitely something that I've never done before pre, you know, this pandemic. But honestly, it's, you know, we're all trying to be very creative and flexible, and it's working pretty well.
I would imagine, though, particularly for a parent of an infant, that's got to be really hard to do visitation that way.
You know, my heart really breaks for the children and their families at this time. And, you know, my children's mother and I talk very frequently about how hard it is to not have that physical connection with their children during this time. And so together we've come up with some creative ways to help mom and children stay connected even when it's outside of our virtual visit time.
Like
for
what?
Instance,
yeah.
Yeah, for instance, you know, I take videos of the babies, you know, in catching their milestones. So I have a young baby who's just learning to roll over, and I had been trying to catch it on video for mom so she could see that.
Uh-huh.
So I've been videoing the baby in my home, and then I have been texting it to mom so she stays connected to her baby. And, you know, it's a really challenging. I really can't imagine what it's like for the biological families at this time and how difficult it is for all children in foster care to not have that physical connection with their families. But, you know, my job as a foster parent is to co-parent with the families and do my best to love the children, give them extra hugs from mom and dad. You know, other things we're doing to keep the connection going is the children's mother has videoed herself reading a bedtime story to the kids. And so part of our nighttime routine now includes mom, when that normally would have never happened before, you know, these visits. Now we're just trying to be very creative in helping the kids hear mom's voice and just offering additional ways for them to stay connected in this era where they may not be able to physically connect.
Let's see. I'm trying to get. Okay. If you have a question or comment, we still have a little time, so give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chip Spinning, what is the rule on parent access to children who are in foster care, natural parent access? How is that typically working?
So I think she just gave a really good example of how it's working. And I think during this time period, what we should be really looking at is what's really working well and what's not. And I think she gave some great examples where in the future, maybe just because of logistics, a parent can't see their child through supervised visit daily or weekly even. But I think we could leverage technology in the future so that we could actually do a better job than we have historically. And so hopefully we can learn from these experiences and do that going forward. I think we're spending some time right now beginning to think about, and we have been, when we sort of open Ohio back up again and what that sort of looks like. Visitation, supervised visitation really occurs in an area where there's can be lots of families and lots of people. So we're looking, actually, if there's partners out there that would be interested in thinking about different ways in which we can really geographically space out supervised visitation, maybe like an unused school system or something like that, with very few people but spread out in a way that could make more sense, I think this is something that we could leverage to get parents access to their children faster.
You know, when I hear Kate Yonkara talk about the bedtime reading ritual that they've started, that seems really natural and makes a lot of sense. Is that the sort of thing you're thinking about as far as using technology to change the dynamic in all of this?
100%. I mean, if parents can stay connected with their kids and see their developmental milestones, it keeps them engaged and working their case plan and resolving some of the concerns that they may have. I think this is a really positive bright spot in some of these challenging times to figure out, you know, how do we not just make this a unique situation, but an ongoing opportunity to keep parents and kids connected and families together, even if it's just virtually.
Do you feel the same way, Kate? Has it kind of changed? I mean, is this something that you'll stop doing when social distancing, all things being equal, ends? Or is it something you're going to continue?
So before social distancing, I did have relationships with biological families. I do offer my personal phone number. I text families. I talk to them on the phone about the care of their children, because the children I care for have maybe some extraordinary special needs that we need to just keep educating, you know, the biological family on. So I might be unique in that case, but in this, I've seen some really neat ways of connecting with this particular family that we're working with right now. And, you know, we're trying to make the visits really fun and just trying new things every day. You know, 2 days ago we had a visit, a virtual visit, and we decided to go outside in our backyard. And so I had, you know, a baby in one hand and a camera in the other. And, you know, I'm not super technological. My tech savviness is not awesome, but I'm trying my best to hold the phone so that the mom can see her baby swinging in a swing in my backyard. And so she feels like she's with us playing in the backyard. And I do see some real value in continuing these types of connections, you know, even once, you know, the state opens back up in our social distances.
I have an email. They ask if when Franklin County Children's Services will start taking donations of gifts, in particular bikes, on anything else that you need, chip spinning. How does that work?
I think that we'll take them anytime, but I believe that the official campaign probably starts off in the early fall, probably in September. But right now we see that families are in need of any kind of, I think that they're just economically challenged right now. So if there's gift cards or maybe even homemade masks for families that can't and don't have the ability to go out and purchase masks and things like that, that could help normalize their life, games, different things that they could have in their home to, you know, we still, like I said, many of our caseworkers, we are doing some virtual visits, but we also have some caseworkers on the front end on assessments. We are definitely seeing our families there. If we're open and working with a case, then sometimes we have more virtual, and it's based on the risk of the placement. But there's no reason why we can't provide games or different things to keep kids engaged and families, you know, active through this time period.
Okay. Well, Chip Spinning, Executive Director, Franklin County Children's Services, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Kate Yonkara, thanks, foster parent from Delaware, works with the Buckeye Ranch. Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.